I'm Nish Wyseth, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. It's Amy's turn to have a week off this week, so it's just me, dear listeners. This week, I talked to Janon Graham Russell, a religion scholar, a PhD candidate at Harvard, and practicing Mormon about the historic new changes that occurred over the weekend in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We also talk about the Me Too movement and how the church is handling it, as well as the faith's long legacy of racism. And for the second half of the show, it's listener Q&A time. Whether through social media, email, or our Patreon page, we get a ton of questions from listeners. So this week, I'll be opening up the mailbag to answer some of those. Some are political, some are religious, and some are personal. It's going to be fun. But before we get started, I want to take a minute to first thank Amy for being so unbelievably patient with me as I moved my family to our new small town in central Idaho, which is still covered in snow. It'll melt eventually. It's been an absolutely insane few weeks, but my house is now unpacked and the kids are in school and we're starting to feel settled. And Amy held down the fort over here with a lot of brilliance as usual. Also, a huge thanks to both Rachel Johnson and Jack Jenkins for stepping in for me as co-host over the last two episodes. Listeners, if you haven't given those a listen yet, make sure you take the time to do so. Really good conversations. Lastly, another huge thank you to those of you who support the podcast every month through our Patreon page. We are so grateful for the generosity of our listeners. And we have got some great things planned for future episodes, and the support of our listeners allows us to keep both the lights on and to move forward on a lot of those plans. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, it's been almost 3 weeks since I've been on the pod, and I'm sure a lot of you were expecting a Titanic-sized rant this week, but I have been buried under boxes, as you can imagine. So my news consumption has been limited at best, and you can also add to the fact that we have really poor internet access right now, which is neither here nor there. Anyway, so I'm going to hold off on my rant until Amy is back next week and we return to regularly scheduled programming. Okay, enough housekeeping. Let's jump right in. What a weekend for the LDS faithful. Last weekend, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints held its semi-annual general conference, where members of the church gather in the conference center in Salt Lake City, in chapels and meeting houses around the world, or simply in their homes with their families and friends, and they listen to the leaders of the faith give inspirational instruction, they announce new changes to doctrine or policy, and they can install new leaders as well. There's a whole host of things that happen during conference weekend. And this past weekend marked a historic moment for the church. First, it participated in what's called a solemn assembly, and it sustained their new prophet, President Russell M. Nelson. If you remember, we talked about Russell M. Nelson a few weeks back. Then, all hell broke loose in the best possible way when the first presidency of the church announced its two newest apostles, Garrett W. Gong and Ulysses Suarez, as members of the Quorum of the Twelve, which after the first presidency is the highest governing body of the church. Elder Gong is an Asian American and Elder Suarez is a Latin American from Brazil, making them the first non-white men to be called as apostles in the church's history. There were a few structural changes to church practices too, and there was an overture, albeit a little controversial, made to the Me Too movement during the conference. And to talk about all the news coming out of Mormon land, I called the brilliant Janon Graham Russell, who's a writer, a religious scholar, PhD candidate at Harvard, and practicing Mormon woman, and asked her to chat with me about it. Janon, thank you so much for coming on the show. It is so great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So this was President Nelson's first conference address as the new prophet of the church. What were your impressions of him in this new role? Do they differ for you from his previous roles that you've seen him in as a leader in the church?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've seen a lot of President Nelson over the years, but I think in this last conference, he really showed us a different side of his personality. And I think that's going to be very important as we move forward. As something that people really loved about President Monson was the way that he told stories and how he smiled and just really connected with people. And I think President Nelson is trying to really channel that.
So there were a lot of really big moments during this conference. I followed the hashtag on Twitter, and there were a couple moments where it felt like all of social media exploded. But the most notable was obviously the announcement of Elders Gong and Suarez being named as apostles. These are the first non-white apostles ever in the church's history. Does this signal a new direction or new era for the church? And what are your perceptions of that moment?
Oh, wow. I mean, I didn't hear anything about that.
Surprise.
Surprise. Well, I'm going to be careful with how I answer this question, because sure. I made a little joke on Twitter the Friday before conference about, you know, if there was a which bracket or is there a bracket for which white men will be chosen for apostles. So some people liked it. A lot of people didn't. So, as far as signaling a new direction, I think absolutely. I think there are many of us who did believe almost 200 years of the church's history, and it's always been older white men. And so, to choose someone who is Asian American, Asian descent, as well as Elder Suarez from Brazil. I think it marks, I don't want to use the word pivot, but I think the church is becoming more aware, or church leaders rather are becoming more aware of their role in the world, and specifically seeing growth in Latin America, seeing growth in Southeast Asia. And so then how will church leaders respond to these changes? It was very interesting to watch the conversations that were happening after the announcement was made, mostly directed towards, you know, who are these men, looking at their background, are they people of color? That was a popular conversation that I saw on the internet. And of course, I mean, Elder Gong is of Asian descent. There were some kind of back and forth about Elder Suarez. Am I saying his name correct? Elder Suarez.
Suarez. I don't know. A lot of people have said it different ways.
Right. And I don't want to catch flack for that later. So Elder Suarez, if you look at the racial dynamics in the United States, he would most likely be identified as a white Latino. Mm-hmm. But most certainly he is from a different culture, and so that's going to bring a lot to the Quorum of the 12. At the same time, I would be interested to see what would have happened if there was Elder Dube or Satati or Elder Echohawk would have been called, just because of the that dynamic relationship between the church in the United States and black people, as well as Native Americans. From a theological standpoint, I'm waiting to see what happens. I'm cautious, other than the tweet that I shot off the other day. I'm cautious because I wonder if their calling is going to become a sort of, you know, reference point for those who, if someone comes to the church and says that, or has valid concerns about racism in the church, if their roles are going to be used as an example that the church has moved on and beyond race and racism, and has become more of a global church. I think it was definitely a game changer. It was, like I said before, it was something that no one expected. And so going forward, I mean, I feel at this point, it's, you know, Mormons love playing basketball. So it's just it's an open court. Like there's so much that's possible now, I think.
Are there more actions that you would like to see from church leadership on racial justice. I read the piece today by, is it Darius or Darius Gray?
Darius Gray.
Darius Gray. He kind of outlined like what members of the church can do to help promote racial reconciliation and kind of overcome racism in the church. And I think it's great that the church put this on its official church blog on the website. It's amazing. But would it make a bigger impact if a piece like this would have been delivered, let's say it's like a conference talk from one of the general authorities? Or is there something more that the church could do from a leadership standpoint to start moving towards a more comprehensive vision of racial justice within the LDS faith?
Oh, absolutely. I think if it was Elder Holland or Elder Uchtdorf, I think it would make a tremendous impact on how race is spoken about and understood within the church as an institution. I think in terms of racial justice, I think we would have to really parse through what we mean by justice. Mm. Because on one hand, you have the justice of God. That's a very, you know, you sin, you're done, like there's going to be consequences for that. Mm. Whereas if we're thinking about racial justice in a social justice setting, mm-hmm. We're talking about racial reconciliation.
Right.
We're talking about, you know, making sure that there's inclusion and being very intentional about that inclusion. Mm-hmm. And I always go back to President Oakes's comments a couple months ago when they had their first press conference, and he talks about quotas and not having a quota, and he's referring to diversity. And so in terms of racial justice, I want to be optimistic and hope that there's some sort of racial reconciliation that happens in the church. But that would take us members, church leaders, the church itself, to face the church's racial history. And I don't know if the church wants to do that. If church leadership wants to go back,
because of the structure of the Mormon Church and because of continuing revelation and kind of all of these different things that happen in the LDS faith, it's a little bit different of an animal to tackle something as big as this from a structural standpoint. In some ways it's easier, because if it just comes from the top, like the top down, it's like, okay, well, it's said and done. But mm-hmm. because it's a global church, because it does have the structure that it does, it's like moving a giant freighter on a dime. It takes a lot more effort. It takes a lot more, I don't want to say thoughtfulness, but maybe intentionality, I guess, to say the right thing, to do it in a way that is appropriate. I was thinking mm-hmm. particularly about some of the criticisms of the leadership that apologizing for the position of not giving Black people the priesthood, just coming out and saying it was wrong and we are sorry, how far that would go. And I wonder if, you know, if there is space to do that, and if the church, with these, you know, new apostles coming forward and what seems like maybe a shift a little bit from in Mormon culture around issues of race, if something like that would even be possible in the future. I don't know. What do you think?
I really enjoyed Darius's piece that was on the blog today. I think it was a very important take, significant take on how we understand racism in the church, or mm-hmm. even racism outside of the church. I think church members, the church itself, navigates this same sort of what is race, what is racism really? Is mm-hmm. racism calling somebody, you know, saying, calling them someone white? Is it calling somebody Black? And I think until we're able to really have the conversation on what racism is, mm. I don't necessarily see that happening. I mean, it would be great to do that, in that, you know, talking about racism in the sense of white supremacy, and that mm-hmm. it's a very complicated situation, and I don't know if the church is really ready to have it or want even wants to have that conversation about race in the church. I mean, even going back to the Elder Gong and Elder Suarez, you think about, you know, even though they come from different cultures, whether or not Elder Suarez is a person of color, you have to think about, you know, this sort of spectrum of race, especially in the United States, that there's always been this white-black binary, and that different people, different groups, racial groups on that spectrum. When it comes to Native Americans, there's this sort of like invisibility, not sort of, there is an invisibility, right? And so so even though you have someone who has an Asian ancestry and someone who's from Brazil, it's this like weird people of non-black people of color still experience racism, but there's also a proximity to whiteness that's different than blackness. And we can see it throughout history. And so, and that's why I'm interested to see how this is all going to play out, because especially with their inclusion, that it's the race discussions might be over just because of that, but it's not understanding that, that for a lot of U.S. history or immigrants, and groups, people who've eventually come to identify themselves as white, they've done that by distancing themselves from black people and from Native Americans. And so it's experiencing racism, but also being able to be complicit in white supremacy and racism. And I'm not saying that Elder Gong and Elder Suarez are, but it's just a very complicated situation, specifically in the United States. I know in Brazil, it's, you know, you have colorism, you know, just the whole history there of colorism. And so then you come here and it's just a whole nother layer of racial ideas about race and racialized bodies. So
super complicated. There's a lot that goes into it. Okay. I want to shift gears just a little bit, or maybe it's a total 180. I'm not really sure. During his talk, Elder Quentin L. Cook made what some would consider to be an overture to the Me Too movement and condemned, quote, non-consensual immorality, unquote. That feels like weird wording, maybe. Is there like, I'm just curious as to your thoughts, like why they would word it that way. Is there like a almost like a squeamish factor in simply calling it sexual assault in a venue that is as formal as General Conference? What is your take here? There's been a lot of commentary about like the language wasn't strong enough, but then some people saying, well, they're never going to say sexual assault in General Conference. So I'm curious, what's your thoughts on the language here? And is this as good as the church is going to do on the issue of like the Me Too movement, or what's happening there? What's your thought?
I guess my first question is, what is non-consensual immorality? It could be so many different things. Like, you know, someone was like playing basketball and I took their ball away from them and they didn't give me permission. Like, I'm not trying to be, you know, I'm trying to be funny, but you know, whether I'm being funny is relative, but like, it's such a ambiguous term that it's, and I understand the hesitancy to say, use the word sex. And I wonder, I'm still scratching my head on in terms of the use of that term, because it just seemed like such, they had the opportunity to be able to talk about this in a very faithful, sacred setting. And it just,
it felt like a swing and a miss almost.
Yeah, it did. they had the opportunity and just, you know, like pass the ball, you know, just pass the ball. I mean, I saw that the woman, her name is McKenna, that she just filed suit against the LDS Church yesterday, and she had a press conference today. And so I wonder if there's a component that the church, they were preparing themselves for what they believed was going to happen. And so, I mean, if you call it sexual assault, I imagine that could be used later on in the court case. And so by naming it or labeling it non-consensual immorality and having the ambiguity, I think that saves them. I think that may help them later on.
Interesting. That's a really interesting
in story. Their minds.
Yeah, totally. That makes total sense. That was going to be my next question. Was there have been some big stories lately about sexual assault cases, this being one of them. I can't remember her last name either. I just saw the story today that she is filing suit against the church because I believe she is claiming she was raped by someone at the MTC, which is the Missionary Training Center, for people who don't know. This is not the first case of alleged sexual assault that has been brought against a member or a leader of the church, not necessarily this high up, but there have been bishops, there have been other kind of lay leaders that have been accused of sexual inappropriateness, of sexual assault. And there's been a lot of talk about what the church is doing to not only prevent sexual assault and harassment, but what it's doing to protect victims. Do you think that the church is doing enough to protect victims? What do you think the church could be doing more of? What's your take?
I think being able to have adults sit in to not have children interviewed by themselves, I think is a mm-hmm. big step.
Yeah.
Recognizing or bishops rather recognizing or having some sort of initiative, either some sort of training or saying that if this happens, that this needs to be referred to the proper authorities and mm-hmm. recognizing that though you may have the priesthood, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have the keys to or use the word keys. that what you have to offer is appropriate for the situation.
Right.
And I think it takes humility and I would love to see more of that happening or speaking about that over the pulpit. Thinking about is the church protecting victims? Is it doing enough to protect victims? Yeah. And I think so working on theology, having training for bishops and church leaders.
Okay. Well, there's obviously a lot to unpack. There's so much happening. There are a lot of big changes, a lot of pivots, I guess. A lot of things that were said. I don't know. Were they pivots? I don't know. Up for debate, maybe. Some people think they were, but I don't know. Maybe like a quarter turn.
Maybe kind of like
yep, exactly. Like just a small little movement. Yeah, which I guess is better than nothing. So
no, absolutely. And I think that I think that gives people a lot of hope, and that's what people were looking for in this conference. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I'm interested to see what happens, and especially with with marriage equality and gay and lesbian couples mm-hmm. and how that's going to, moving forward and looking at the family proclamation and, is that going to become part of greater doctrine? Is it not? Mm-hmm. I guess we'll have to see. So race, sexuality, gender, there's a lot there. So
yeah, there's a lot on the table. Well, I will be, as always, keeping my eye on it because I'm fascinated and love it and lived amongst it for a long time. So anyway, thank you so much for coming on the show and kind of unpacking all of it for us. It was such a joy to have you. I always love following your insights and your perspective, and it's just always so helpful and informative. So thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks again for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. A huge thanks to Janon for coming on the show. And as always, we'll be keeping an eye on what's happening in the Mormon Church as these new developments move forward. Okay. For the last half of the show, as promised, I'm going to open the mailbag for a little Q&A session. So let's go ahead and jump right in. Okay, first, we have a question from my friend and member of the Pod Squad, Steve Evans, who asks, okay, here's a question. What the hell is up with you buying a snowmobile? Okay, first of all, Steve, you know why we have a snowmobile. You know the answer to this question. We moved to a small town in the mountainous area of central Idaho. And when we lived in Utah, okay, I should preface this actually. My husband is a big backcountry skier. So he likes to hike up mountains and then ski down in like the out of bound ranges. I don't know why you would hike up a mountain and ski down when there are chairs that take you up the mountain. But that is a difference of opinion. So anyway, he is a big backcountry skier, loves to access all the crazy terrain and the trees and jump off cliffs and all that stuff. And in Utah, the access to that kind of terrain was pretty easy. You could drive just up the canyon and essentially just start hiking up the road or from the road up to get some of the best snow, some of the best lines that you can ski. And that is different here in central Idaho. To get to any of that terrain, you either have to have access to a snowcat or a snowmobile. So we were not even here 5 days and my husband bought a snowmobile, which whatever. Anyway, so one of my concessions was, okay, you can have a snowmobile if I can get new dishes for the house. So I got a brand new set of dishes, which I got the short end of the stick on this trade when I told Eric that I wanted a new set of dishes in exchange for a snowmobile. I don't think I've seen him agree to something so quickly. So if he gets a second snowmobile, then mommy may be getting a new washer dryer too, but and maybe a spa day. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So that is why we have a snowmobile, Steve. Okay. The next question comes from Charlotte. She asks, how do you think the proposed rollbacks to the ADA relate to the White House and church views on disability and the rampant acceptance of ableism? This is such a good question. For those of you who are not familiar, the ADA is the acronym for the Americans with Disabilities Act. First, let me say that I am not surprised by the rollbacks or the desire to roll back some of those protections. The inclusion and protection of marginalized people in this country isn't exactly what the Republican Party is known for in recent years. Am I right? So, as it relates to the White House, well, I mean, let's get real. We elected a guy who openly mocked a man with a disability. So, any import given to the ADA is going to be slim at best for this administration. But as for the church, I think that this is a harder question. So many view disability through wildly different theological lenses to start. Some people believe that all disabilities will be quote unquote healed in heaven. Some believe they won't. Some believe that some will and others won't. It's all quite varied. But what we can firmly establish is that the church can and must do better to include, be hospitable to, and accommodate people with all disabilities in their churches. Full stop. If evangelicals of all political stripes were true leaders on disability rights and inclusion, would the ADA be in such peril now? Who knows? Probably not. That would be my guess. But either way, the church should be leading on this, and it's not. And in too many instances, it can be the church that's perpetuating ableism. So I think that there's a lot to unpack there. But the first thing is, I think we have to come to an understanding that the Christian belief structure is going to understand disability in a theological context in a different way. And because of that, it's going to interact with people with disabilities in different ways. So it'd be hard to find a cohesive model for interaction and engagement with people with disabilities. So hard question, and probably even more convoluted answer. Okay. Next question. This one is from Gina. How can we learn to be united as Christians, even among our different theologies? Oh, well, that's a question. But to be honest, you know what? Now that I'm like thinking about it, I honestly don't think it's that hard. And we make things way more complicated than we need it to be often. So I don't know. But I will say it probably is easier said than done. Here's what I would say. How can we come together and be more united? First, we have to come to the table around what we have in common. So I think we find common ground and then we agree to come around the table around those things. Not about what's different. We leave that checked at the door for the sake of conversation, but we come to the table around what we have in common. Second, this is something that we've been really bad at, especially in our culture. We need to assign positive intent with one another. That can go so far. That can take you so far in any conversation with people who disagree. Is if you assign positive intent. So what I mean by that is assume that that person is coming to the table with the right motives, right? That they are coming to the table wanting to achieve good in the world just like you are. So assign positive intent with one another. Third, we need to come to the table with humility, which is a rare trait. I am exceptionally bad at this. No one has the corner on every issue, and everyone has something to learn from each other. I think that if we took that posture of humility and just assumed that I don't have the corner and I don't have all the answers and I may actually learn something from somebody else at the table, then we could probably find a lot more common ground otherwise. So I think if we did those three things, we would probably see a world of difference. But like I said, much easier said than done, because all of those things require something of us, right? It requires us to be humble and to do a lot of internal work for us to go develop humility in ourselves and to assign positive intent with one another. It takes a generosity of heart and compassion to do those things. And so it's incredibly difficult, but I do think that if we really do want to achieve unity, and if that's something that we really do want to see happen in our communities, and we really do want to work towards unity, those are things that are going to have to be almost like non-negotiables, I think. So those are my thoughts on that. Okay. Next question is from Erin. She asks, I am a 27-year-old Christian, and I've lived in the Bible Belt for my entire life. While the overwhelming majority of my Christian neighbors and family members are extremely conservative, so America guns and maybe a bit of God thrown in there if they can twist him to fit their own agenda, my own relationship with Jesus has led me to a more left-leaning position, which has essentially left me wide open to all kinds of unkind and ugly criticism, literally any time I express an opinion. The first part of my question is this. I don't want to live in a bubble of people who believe the same way I do, because I genuinely believe that the only way we're going to accomplish anything truly meaningful is by crossing the aisle and working together. Can you share some practical examples of how you've done this, especially in situations where you faced opposition? What worked, what didn't, etc.? Secondly, but in the same vein, how do you maintain healthy boundaries with people who often intentionally speak and behave in ways that are hurtful? Good questions, Erin. Let me do my best, because they're also very big questions. First, I think this piggybacks off of my previous answer to the question prior to yours. I think one of the best things that we can do is assign positive intent and have humility in our interactions with people who disagree. I think it goes a long way. But I will take it a step further with your question and also say, I think we need to genuinely ask people about themselves and their stories. I have found personally that the more I ask someone about their story, the more I get context for why they hold certain positions. So for example, I have a friend who has very strong opinions about gun control, but she holds those opinions because she watched her brother get shot in their own apartment when she was a child. And I have another friend who holds really strong opinions about abortion, but she had an abortion when she was 15, and she's still living with that decision even today in some pretty devastating ways. So maybe it's someone's faith, maybe it's just the culture that they live in. You never know until you ask. So that I would probably suggest that too. Ask them more about themselves and their story. I think you'd be surprised by what you find out. The second part, boundaries. You know, that's a really good question. There's a saying that I've always kept in my back pocket, and it's hurt people hurt people. So people who are intentionally hurtful are usually masking their own pain. And it may be pain that's totally unrelated. It usually is, but it's likely unresolved pain. It doesn't excuse their behavior, but it allows us to look at others with compassion, even in the midst of feeling wounded by their actions. So it doesn't mean we remain in close relationship with them. We may need to set those boundaries. But if we have an understanding that their hurtful dialogue or their hurtful actions are likely coming from a place of deep pain that they may not even recognize in themselves, we can set those boundaries from a place of grace and generosity rather than from a place of wounding, if that makes sense. So those would probably be my suggestions, but that's just me. It's a really hard question. Okay, next question is from Calibag. I think that's how you say your Instagram name. Anyway, on Instagram. What are some of your personal rituals or things you go to when you're feeling disconnected to God or that out of sorts kind of feeling? Oh man. Okay. Number one, I try to get outside. Even if it's for like a short 5-minute walk. If I do that every day, it can slow me down and force me to pay attention to the beauty of God. That is something that I try to do. I'm really bad at, but it seems like every time I do it, it works. So number one, try to get outside. Number two, I should have prefaced this with, this is just me and my own experience. Take it with a grain of salt. Okay. Number two, I write down my thoughts. I write down everything I'm thankful for. I write down what my Mormon friends call tender mercies, or the seemingly small, insignificant ways that God has showed up and left a fingerprint on the day. So I write those down. Number three, I read. I read scripture, usually from another translation, so it feels fresh. And I also read novels. I love reading novels. Human creativity always wakes me up to the creativity of God. And I connect most deeply to human creativity through the written word. And so fantastic stories and fantastic characters open me up to the beauty of God in a very unique way. So I know that's not the same for everyone, but I love to read novels. All of that to say, I try to do things that wake me up, so to speak, because when I find that I feel disconnected to God, it's likely because I haven't been paying much attention to how he's already been present. So the disconnection usually has to do with me, not with God. God has been present. I am usually the one who is not awake and is not aware of the ways that he has been present in my life on a day-to-day basis. So I try to do things that wake me up, but that's just me. Okay. Next question. This is from Emily. How is the move going for your family? Any tips for me as I prepare to move to a new state with my husband and young kids? Oh, Lord. Okay. Oh, man. Okay, two big questions. First, how is the move? It's okay. It's okay. Things were going great for a short while, and we seem to have hit a rut this week. Lots of homesickness from the kids and, you know, frankly, from me too. Like any big transition, it's a lot. It's a lot of work, emotionally especially, but as a parent, you carry your child's emotion too, in a way. You have to help them process through it. So that's where we are. Lots of big emotions from lots of big personalities in our house. Everyone in our house has very big personality. Which leads me to the answer to your second question. Any tips for you? Tips. Okay, the only one that I can think of off the top of my head is just give everyone lots and lots and lots of grace. It's like the only thing you can do. It is a big transition for everyone to move, especially to a new town. And everyone in the house is going to deal with it differently. So give yourself and your kids a really big buffer. So go ahead and assume that you'll see some new, maybe not so great behaviors, especially from little ones. Just give yourself a lot of grace as you help them process, and just give them lots of grace as they adapt. It just takes a lot out of them, and it's going to take a lot out of you as their parent. And also just you as a person, as a human. Like, it's a lot to move. It's a lot to leave behind, a life that you love, or maybe you didn't love it. I don't know. Either way, you had gotten used to something, and you had your routines, and you had things that were, you know, just kind of your everyday. You had your friends, you had your community, and you're leaving all of that behind. So anyway, just give everyone lots of grace, including yourself, as everyone adapts. So yeah. Okay. Also, maybe my only practical piece of advice is to get unpacked as fast as you can, which I know feels really daunting, especially when you're like looking at a house and everything gets loaded into your house and it's all in boxes and none of the boxes are in the right room. Or at least it feels that way sometimes. But the sooner the house starts to feel like home, the sooner your kids, I think, will absorb that it's home and they'll start to feel safe. And so I think you'll start seeing some of those behaviors and some of those big emotions. Like, they will still come up. Of course they will. But creating that space is really important. I have found that it's amazing what physical space does for people, especially children. So get those big living spaces and their bedroom or playroom unpacked first. Make sure they see their stuff out sooner rather than later. I think that helps create a sense of safety and refuge and familiarity, which is what we want our kids to feel when they're home anyway, right? That this is home base, that this is your safe place. So that would be my practical piece of advice. The more philosophical one is lots and lots of grace. Practical piece is just do the really hard work, do the late nights for like a week or two and just get it done, get it unpacked. You'll be so glad. You'll be so glad when it's all said and done. So that is my advice. Okay, that is all for the Q&A portion of the show. To wrap up the show every week, we like to leave you with a recommendation, a TV show, a movie, maybe some music. Like I mentioned earlier, our internet is terrible and we don't have cable TV or anything yet. So we have not watched anything because we can't get anything to stream right now. Like, can barely watch Netflix and it's just kind of a disaster. So we have to wait until the snow melts, until they can install a line of cable to our house. Anyway, it's this whole thing, whatever. So I have not watched or listened to much of anything lately, but I have been reading some books. And so I'm going to give you an amazing book recommendation. I am almost at the end of reading a book called What Are We Doing Here? By Marilynne Robinson, who is the author of Gilead, which won the Pulitzer. What Are We Doing Here is a collection of essays that were developed from talks and lectures and sermons that she has given in recent years. And it is clear, if it wasn't already, that she is truly, you guys, truly one of our nation's greatest, deepest, most honest thinkers. Truly. She asks huge questions in this book, and she often doesn't really have any solid answer, which I love. But she has a lot of insight and she provokes a lot of thought that can lead you to asking your own big questions, which is, I mean, I think a true sign of brilliance. So anyway, it's a must read. Go pick it up. It's called What Are We Doing Here by Marilynne Robinson, the author of Gilead. Do not miss it. That is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining me. Amy will be back next week. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It is the very best way to let other people know about us. You can share us on social media as well. If you would like to support the show financially, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so that we can continue to expand these conversations. There's a link to the page in the show description. And as always, we'll post the show notes on our website. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.